The time being 8:15, the House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. First order of business, we do have a quorum, and Representative Vernick would like to move approval of the minutes from Tuesday, February 26, 2026. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from Tuesday, February 26, 2026, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved for February 26, 2026. First order of business today is Representative Vernick. I should note that all the bills today will be laid over for your edification and planning purposes. The first bill is House File 3469. Representative Vernick moves that House File 3469 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Vernick, to your bill.
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment. This amendment extends the appropriation date for the DCT Advisory Committee from 2027 to 2028.
All right, Representative Vernick moves the A1 amendment. Are there any questions or discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Vernick.
Thank you. Before you is House File 3469, a bipartisan bill. It does two things. One, it extends the appropriation for the DCT Advisory Committee from June 30th, 2027 to June 30th, 2028. The DCT Advisory Committee expires December 31st, 2027. However, the one-time funding appropriated is only available until June 30th, 2027. As a member of the committee, we would like the date of the appropriation to be bumped out to June 30th, 2028. So we would be able to pay out any expenses that are submitted to the DCT, to DCT after the committee end date. It also extends direct care and treatment county correctional facility support pilot program appropriation from June 30th, 2026 to June 30th, 2027. In 2024, the legislature appropriated a little over $2 million to direct care and treatment to develop a county correctional facility support pilot program. The Priority Admissions Task Force recommended the creation of this program, which is tasked with helping county jails administer psychotropic medications to individuals with serious mental illness. The pilot has completed data collection, begun building partnerships with many counties, county correctional facilities, and held several training sessions. However, the team needs more time to refine services, scale operations, and demonstrate measurable outcomes. The program's one-time appropriation will expire June 30, 2026. The bill extends that pilot to June 30, 2027 using carryover funds, so there will be no more appropriation. And we do have Dr. Cruz here from DCT if you have questions about that program.
All right. Is there any discussion to what was just presented? All right, final word, Representative Vernick.
Well, thank you, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and committee members. This bill is literally a gift of time, so thank you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Vernick renews her motion that House File 3469, as amended, is to be laid over. Next, we will do House File 3526, Representative Schumacher.
Chair Schumacher, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that House File 3526 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Schumacher, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we begin, I would like to move the A2 amendment. Some technical changes and requests from the Department of Health on getting this bill into a fashion that is workable and pleasing.
Wonderful. All right, let's discussion to the A2 amendment. Members. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members. Many of us share the goal of increased access to home care services that allow older Minnesotans and those with disabilities or complex health needs to remain living in their homes and with their families. Access to home health services is most often the preferred choice of our constituents compared to care in a hospital or other long-term care settings. Access to home health services is a key step in easing the stress in our currently overstressed hospitals and other congregate care facilities. And access to home care saves our state a significant amount of funding as compared to providing this care in other settings. The bill before you today, brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association, offers two small steps the state can take to strengthen home care services in Minnesota. This bill does two things: updates the structure for use of home care fine dollars to align more closely with changes passed into law last session for assisted living fine dollars and to allow for consistency and clarity. And number two, it ensures timely filling of vacancies in the Minnesota Department of Health's Home Care and Assisted Living Advisory Council. I'd like to thank Co-Chair Knorr for joining me to co-author this bill, and would like to thank MDH for working with the bill proponents on the language for the bill, getting us to this place today where all parties, we believe, are comfortable with the current language and with the inclusion of the amendment. I will now turn over to my testifier, Kathy Meserly, for testimony in support of the bill.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Schumacher. My name is Kathy Meserly, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Home Care Association, whose members provide hands-on care to more than 30,000 older Minnesotans and individuals with disabilities in their own homes. As Chair Schumacher stated, this bill contains two small process improvement steps the state can take to continue to strengthen the state's home care service system. Sections 1 and 3 of the bill update the structure for use of home care fine dollars to align with language that was passed by the legislature last session. That language attached very clear procedural and timeline requirements to the process MDH uses for awarding competitive grant dollars to assisted living providers. This proposal in the bill aims to mirror that language and applies these additional process improvement measures to the process for awarding grants to home care providers. The intent with this proposal is to have greater clarity for all stakeholders on the process used for awarding the grants and to allow MDH to have a more aligned and consistent process for awarding the funds. Section 2 of the bill implements a timeline within which vacancies must be filled by the Minnesota Department of Health's Home Care and Assisted Living Advisory Council. This advisory council has been in existence for some time and is charged with providing advice regarding the MDH's regulation of home care and assisted living providers. State statute outlines the 14 roles that must be represented in the membership of the council. It is critical that each of these 14 voices be able to contribute to the work of the council. Last year, an extensive delay in the selection of qualified applicants for appointment to the vacant positions led to a gap in voices at the table. The language in this bill lays out a clear and common sense timeline for filling the vacancies. We would like to thank MDH for working with us on the details of these proposals. In closing, I want to thank the committee for taking time to hear this bill today. As our state works to bring better access to home care services to Minnesotans across the state, we must look at all steps that will help us move in that direction. We believe these small but meaningful process improvements will benefit Minnesotans. I would also like to note that the bill has been endorsed by the Minnesota Leadership Council on Aging. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Is there any other questions or comments from the audience or testimonies? All right, seeing none, member discussion. All right, no discussion. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to inquire about the balance in this program, but also the process whereby we can be able to continue funding that program based on the regulations put forward in state grant program rather than specifying the 10% here. I don't know if anybody from the agency is here to explain where we are with the funding and whether we need to define the 10% or use the Chapter 16 definition.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Knorr. I do believe there is someone who is very happy to come and help you with your question.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
All right, Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Daphne Pons. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'm a manager with the Assisted Living and Home Care Programs.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Pons, I just wanted to know the current account, the special revenue account. What is the current balance for the home care program? Or is it all combined into one?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, there is a combined special revenue account, but for the home care dollars, there's approximately $1.5 million currently.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for that program, and is it only specifically for the home care program, or does it transcend beyond that? Does it go to the assisted living or other programs?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, the home care, so essentially right now there's a special revenue account where both the assisted living and home care dollars go into. This proposal mirrors on January 1st, 2026, this legislature passed a law last year for the assisted living grants, and so there is a grant program for assisted living currently that this mirrors. And so the total amount right now for home care and assisted living is a little over $5 million. But there is a delineation between the 144A for the home care licensees for those fines and then delineation for the assisted living 144G fines.
Chair
Noor. Thank you so much for that clarity because of the difference between the two sections. And also the other question that I have is on line 4.3, it specifies the 10%. Is the plan within the agency to comply with the new regulations under 16B.981, I believe?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, yes, the department did give technical assistance on this language, and we would be able to comply with the way that the wording is. Yes.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to know when a provider is with temporary license, were they excluded from the grant if they are able to apply for the grant? That is line 4.2.
Chair, Representative Noor, I believe they're excluded.
That was the question. If there's a need for someone with temporary license and they need to be in compliance, and why will they be excluded from a grant that will help them to be in compliance?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Noor, I guess I would have to look at the language a little closer. I know under the assisted living grant program that provisional licensees are excluded, and in this particular language, I'm not seeing that line.
I think it was
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair Noor.
That is line 4.1. It's 4.1 and 4.2.
It was intended to mirror the assisted living, so you could just say that.
Yep, I got it. Okay, I see. All right, just my glasses. Okay, Madam Chair, Representative Noor. Yes, I see that. There was an intent for this to mirror the 144G language, and so I see here under that line that a provider with a temporary license under the chapter is not eligible to apply. And so I think my understanding, at least, with the intent was that it was to have only those with full valid licensure to be able to receive the grant, and not those that may be denied upon survey. It's potential that they could be denied after their initial survey of that licensure and then would have those dollars that they really haven't paid into at that point with the fine monies.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So for how long does the provider hold the temporary license?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, it is dependent. They are essentially the license is good for 1 year for 12 months, and so then it's just dependent on the department to get out to do the actual survey at that point once they've been granted the temporary basic or temporary comprehensive license, which the goal is to do that within 90 days, but you know it could take a little bit longer just depending on the resources at the time for the survey process.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that, to me, that no temporary license provider will be paying into fines because they may be excluded completely. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, the department has the discretion under 140A. It says may fine, and so we do make a decision on that on a case-by-case basis. I would say that oftentimes, though, if there is a denial, oftentimes we would not do associated fines just because it is a denial and we don't want to be overly punitive, but it would be looked at on a case-by-case basis, and we have discretion whether or not to fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, I think we need to look through find ways of understanding if there's a temporary license or provisional license, if they're paying into the fines, then there should be a way to address if they're technical assistance in nature to make sure that they're in compliance, because that's our goal, to ensure that every provider who is enrolled, who's able to get any technical assistance to be able to be in compliance, we can help them. Not all the providers, but those who are doing their job in good faith, they should be able to get some help from the agencies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other discussion? All right. Do you have any closing remarks, Chair Schumacher?
Just to say, Madam Chair, thank you for the time today, and I'd like to renew my motion that House File 3526 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
All right, seeing no further discussion, House File 3526 is laid over as amended.
Next up is House File 3375, Representative Curran. Representative Curran moves that House File 3375 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Representative Curran's, when you're ready, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. There we go. Thank you. All right. Thank you so much. The bill in front of you today is brought forward by our friends at ARM. And amends changes that were put in place last session to a service called Individualized Home Supports with Training, which supports people on the disability waiver living in their own home. Previously, individuals could be assessed to receive up to 16 hours a day of IHST. Last session, at the end of the session, this was capped at 6 hours daily. For individuals that need those critical services to maintain their independence and continue to live in their own home, the results of these hard caps could make it incredibly difficult to stay in their own home instead of a community residential setting. This House File 3375 establishes flexibility in the daily cap by instead creating a monthly cap, which brings me to the point that I believe we have an amendment to adopt as well.
Yes, Representative Curran moves the A1 amendment. Representative Curran, to your amendment.
Yes, the A1 would reflect what I just said and changes the bill language from an annual cap to a monthly cap.
Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Curran, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. So as amended, it doesn't increase the number of hours or units of service that would be available with the current 6-hour daily cap, but instead it allows for a person-centered daily flexibility. It also addresses individuals with complex needs who require more significant level of support. This bill proposes to remove caps for individuals who meet the new residential services support criteria. Individuals meet this criteria if they are assessed to have a complex medical or complex behavioral need. We want to ensure that no barriers exist to living independently in your own home, and removing the cap for these individuals will help to ensure that everyone has a choice in where they want to live. Last session, as a committee, we know it was really hard to make some tough budget decisions. This is an attempt to look back at that work, at some of the decisions that were made, and make sure that people with disabilities aren't losing their access to services as a result. I do understand that the department would like to discuss some changes to language in the bill. We've chatted this morning already, and we'll be working together while the bill is laid over. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Ms. Grafstrom, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and members of the Human Service Committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I'm the Senior Director of State and Federal Policy at ARM, representing over 200 home and community-based service providers. I'm here today to testify on a specific service called Individualized Home Supports, or IHS. IHS is one of the services available to people on a disability waiver who are living in their own home, meaning the service provider does not have any control over the physical home and provides services as needed per the individual service authorization. There are three tiers to the IHS service. Individualized Home Supports is a service that provides support to individuals. Individualized Home Supports with Training, the service that this bill addresses, provides both support and training to individuals. And Individualized Home Supports with Family Training provides both support and training to an individual and their family. What do we mean when we say training? This can look different for each individual who accesses the service. For some, the training piece of their service may be budgeting, cooking, or working on healthy living skills. For others, it may be cueing and guidance throughout the day, positive support strategies or support in increasing positive behavior throughout the day. Depending on the person and the individual needs that day, the service can look different day to day. This is an extremely personalized service. This is what makes the hard 6-hour cap so challenging. We cannot put people in a box where their needs for the training portion of their service go away, and we cannot lose perspective that Individualized Home Supports with Training is not just a training service, but a training and support service. ARM supports House File 3375 as amended, which will remove the daily cap and instead take us to a monthly limit, allowing the day-to-day flexibility for individuals. We also support the legislation's language that removes a 3-hour consecutive cap, giving individuals the ability to direct how and when they want their services provided to them. While we strongly support these proposals, we also want to acknowledge that this flexibility will not address the needs of individuals with complex needs currently receiving up to 16 hours a day of support. And I'll just mention in total, according to data we see from the department, there are 54 individuals statewide that receive 16 hours. That's why we support removing the cap for these individuals, ensuring that they have access to the amount of services they need to continue living successfully in their own home. Before turning it over to our other testifiers, I want to close by sharing some feedback from some of our members when asked what the 6-hour cap will mean to individuals they are supporting. One member shared, "The newly passed limit of 6 hours per day will make it extremely difficult for us to provide the level of support many individuals need. Our clients often require care and guidance throughout the day to stay safe, engaged, and connected to their communities." Another went on to say, "Individuals who need these services will lose their choice and their ability to receive the full support they need. Reducing services to just 6 hours will leave gaps in essential care and supervision, place heavy strain on families and caregivers, and limit opportunities for individuals to participate in work, school, and social activities." ARM urges you to support House File 3375. I want to thank the committee for their time and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. Next, we have Jeremy Wendt. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Jeremy Wendt. I'm the executive director of EGH, a small nonprofit HCBS provider in the Western suburbs. We are here, we support Bill House File 3375 because of the limits in place that would cause a switch from an intensive service known as Individualized Home Supports with Training into what's known as a basic service, Individualized Home Supports. The basic service really provides cueing and assistance for people in the realms of community participation, health and safety, household management, and adaptive skills. This is a limited support program, paid at a smaller rate for people who may have the abilities already that only require limited support to achieve these goals. On the other hand, individualized home support with training involves actively teaching and tracking progress of skills within those four service categories. The IHS with training also tracks a person's goals and wishes to assure that the service is moving their life forward. IHS with training also has a designation within the community-based service manual as a habilitative service. And habilitative services are designed to help people with disabilities develop, maintain, and improve the self-help, socialization, and adaptive skills necessary to live successfully in their home and in the community. And that is the reason that IHS with training is an intensive service. It provides both the basic supports of the basic service as well as the training and the more intensive supports. And that's why before last year, the Home and Community-Based Service Manual said that if a person wants the same provider to deliver both IHS services, the lead agency should authorize IHS with training, because it meets both the person's support and training needs flexibly in a single service. And so the 3 and 6 hour caps really does impinge the rights of the person to receive the services when and where they want them. We have one individual who we have adapted her program as a kind of a pilot before these rules are instituted so that we could see how they work in the real world. And so a person may choose to have all of their IHS with training units provided in 1 to 2 long days per week instead of 3 to 5 visits per week. And so a professional's 3 hour or 6 hour clock might go off in the middle of an essential service. For example, we had one individual who was being supported and we had instituted as a pilot this 3 and 6 hour cap. The 3 hour alarm, so to speak, for the staff went off right in the middle of a phone call with a pharmacist. They were making adjustments to medications and ensuring that person had the meds they need. And so according to the rules, that staff would have needed to just check out immediately and go into the different basic service, even though she would still have been providing the intensive service. And given the CMS requirements for electronic visit verification, where you don't want to have edited entries into what we do, otherwise it can create flags and create an impression of fraud, and especially get here in Minnesota with the increased attention on fraud and the new prepayment screening program, we want as little after-the-fact editing and changes of our electronic visit verification entries as possible. And so eliminating the 3 hour or 6 hour cap really gives those individuals who want to load all of their support needs in 1 or 2 visits while still creating the hourly cap and the cost associated with lowering those limits from last legislative session.
All right, Mr. Wend, thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Lee and Mark Storing. Welcome to the committee. When you're ready, please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher, Chair Nor, members of the committee. I'm Mark Storing. I am the father and guardian of one of the 54 individuals noted with the complex behavioral medical needs. Thank you for the opportunity to join this morning and speak in support of HF 3755 and specifically the need to remove service caps for individuals who meet the new residential service support criteria, especially as it relates to those individuals with those complex behavioral and medical needs. Our adult son is among those Minnesotans for which getting this late legislation right is really critical. Although we will share our story, it is also the story for other families with high special needs individuals as well. As I said, I'm Mark Storing. I'm father and guardian of David. I'm with my wife, Lee. mother, guardian of David. We're mom and dad. This is David. If you have good eyes, you can see he's a big Wild fan. I noticed this morning driving in, he's actually got a Twins hat on, too. He's kind of the ultimate homer. A great kid. As I said, we are urgently seeking your support on HF 3375 to ensure that our son David and others like him will be able to continue their current program, individual home support with training, with the current 16 hours. This program has been life-changing for our son and our whole family. It provides the safety critical to David's needs. David is 33. As a young boy, he was diagnosed with developmental delays, autism, depression, psychosis, impulse control disorder. David has self-injurious behaviors when he's under stress. He exhibits strong echolalia, often repeating what others say and what he believes to be accepted, the accepted answer rather than what may be real. Regrettably, all of this creates a lot of challenges for David. These behaviors required him to be supported with one-on-one programming throughout his school years, but with that support, he was able to attend Intermediate District 287 and graduate high school. He has had episodes of tachycardia, esophagitis, and stricture, as well as varicose veins with complications. In addition to the above, he's healing from metatarsal bone fractures from a severe accident in 2023. This accident resulted in more than a year of physical recovery and lingering trauma from being run over as a pedestrian in a crosswalk by a pickup truck. We're fortunate he was not killed. David needs assistance throughout his day to navigate and understand the world around him. Supervision is necessary for all medication administration throughout the day, as well as every aspect of daily hygiene and self-care. He needs assistance each day to dress appropriately. He needs significant help with all meal prep, healthy choices, portion sizes. Care is also needed overnight to ensure his safety. Throughout the 24-hour day, David benefits greatly from knowledgeable, skilled caregivers for sensory calming, mood regulation, and all basic living area activities to assist him in keeping safe. Those caregivers communicate over the various shifts to ensure consistency in implementing strategy and advancing creative development of new strategies to assist David. All that said, I want you to know that David has a heart of gold. If our schedule wasn't so early this morning, we would have brought David along for you to meet. In the Department of Human Services Individualized Home Support with Training Program, David feels a sense of safety. In that program, we have found the most success of any program of his life. He experiences consistent, skilled staff who work to understand his needs, his abilities, and communication style while encouraging his participation in all aspects of life. His abilities with instruction and care, David helps with his day-to-day living, including participating in adaptive activities in the community. The importance of a regular routine in his home is critical for David's ability to address daily challenges and given his disabilities. For those of you who may be familiar with individuals with autism and similar spectrum disorders, routine, consistency in what daily living and in interaction with staff is just critically important and makes everything easier in everybody's life of his care team. Solid communications with staff ensures successful outcomes. He has allowed person-centered care rather than an institutionalized approach. Importantly, resources can be directed toward proficient staff with expertise for instruction, care, and safety. The level of safety provided by the individual home support with training program had not been realized in the past when we tried group home care. Regrettably, the group home program could not provide the necessary level of support. For David, the program resulted in significant weight gain, causing vein issues requiring multiple surgeries. He also experienced tachycardia episodes requiring EMT visits and emergency room visits brought on by stress. Elopements became a behavioral problem, which resulted in calls to the police and ultimately the 2023 accident as noted prior. He was left unsupervised by a group home staff member out in the community. We did involve MCCP, the Metro Crisis Coordination Programming, on several occasions to work with staff and David for stronger care, but unfortunately, it just wasn't enough to keep him safe in a group home setting. After the accident, we worked and continued to work many months with MCCP and David's case manager to find any program with adequate care for David. His medical needs and behaviors are extensive, and we recognize that. We found the individualized home support with training program and found success for David partnering with the Learnability Organization for IHS training with who is his IHS with training service provider. Lee.
David is now in a safe environment. He is in his own home. With the support he needs. He is supervised by skilled, caring, consistent staff and attends important day programs. He participates in social outings and he gets frequent exercise. The last 24 months of David's has been the most successful in his life. He is safe. We've avoided emergency room visits. We've avoided first responders calls. And the elopements have stopped. He is happy with his home, and he is happy with his staff. He loves the adaptive recreation program put on by the metro area, and this is a shout out to the Arley organization. They have great programs. To deviate from this care program now would put David's physical and mental health back in danger, as we have already experienced. The individualized home support with training program has proven to be life-changing for David and our whole family. It enables David to safely participate in life and reveal his heart of gold. I'd like to speak to you a little bit about the training. It may not be the training in the typical way that you and I think of training, where you get instruction, you learn it, you apply it. The definition of training for a special needs person is usually far more basic, but it is critical safety and life skills training built right into his day-to-day, consistently, by trained and caring staff, like how to dress appropriately for the weather and the skills necessary for basic hygiene, which greatly affect his health and wellness. He is able to learn. Will he be able to live on his own? No. But this training is showing real progress. With this daily, consistent, integrated training model provided by the Department of Home Human Services and implemented by skilled staff, he is learning. And he is so proud to be learning his version of independence. These goals are tracked, they're monitored, and he loves reaching the goals. We are desperately imploring the Department of Human Services and the legislature to continue to support this proven person-centered care model in David's own home. We applaud the creation of individualized home support with training model and Learnability's success in implementing this model. David is a wonderful person. He loves people. If animals or elderly are in need, David is your volunteer. He takes pride in being able to help others while he himself is receiving services. Our life's objective as we approach our 70s is to ensure that our son is in a safe, sustainable living situation for when we're no longer around. We believe we may have found that with this individualized home supports with training program. Now, as you look at this legislation, look at David. Restricting daily hours within the program to 6 hours a day would be catastrophic for him and other individuals with high, complex medical and behavioral challenges. David needs 24-hour support. Limiting the number of hours of care will not change that 24/7 need. We implore your support of House File 3375. Again, we thank you for your time to learn about our son today, the unique high need of nature of his support. We are happy to provide clarification or any additional information regarding the comments that we've made this morning. We welcome your questions. Please ask.
Mr. and Ms. Storing, thank you for your testimony this morning. Thank you for making the time up here. It was certainly testimony I needed to hear, and I'm sure others on the committee feel the same way. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3375? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to get clarity. The proposal before us and the House File 3375, Representative Corrin, does this change the number of hours from six to increase to the number of daily hours, or is this just aggregating that we have a limit based on a monthly, based on the amendment that we have?
Representative Curran. Ms. Grabstrom.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr. So it does both. for individuals that don't meet the complex need, it would just take their daily limit and move it to a monthly limit. So keeping within the same 6 hours a day, we took the 15 minutes per hour with four units per hour, which is why we have that 24 times the number of days in the month. So that we're just trying to create that monthly unit to create flexibility for the individuals that Mr. Wendt spoke about that, you know, might not need the support all the time, but something might come up on a day-to-day where instead of that six-hour hard cap, they really need 7 hours of support that day. They might be on a medical appointment that's going long or something else happening that flexibility would be important. For individuals like David, who have that complex need, who need that 24-hour support, there's no monthly cap or monthly flexibility that's going to meet his needs. And so for those individuals, we're trying to find a solution to make sure that they can continue to get their needs met in their own home as well.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is, the current changes that were proposed last year have not yet been implemented. So as we know that CMS will have to wait for the implementation of the limit and then pick up if there are any additional changes, also waiting for federal change. So as we know right now, that new process that we passed last year will have to be implemented and executed. So that means there will be a limit if and when we get the approval from CMS. So how are we preparing the residents, individuals who are waiting to get that service?
Ms. Grabstrom.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, and I'm sure Mr. Wendt as a provider can also speak to this, but last year the department or the legislature also passed language that allows providers to couple the IHST service with IHS. And so I think we're looking at that as a potential short-term Band-Aid solution to get us to what we're hoping is more of a long-term sustainable solution for individuals.
Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is there any limit on the IHS basic without, you know, training?
Ms. Grabstrom.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, I do not believe so.
Chair Knorr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Representative Hicks.
First of all, I want to say thank you for bringing folks who are receiving services and directly the end user to committee. I think it's really important, and it always makes me happy when we get to have those conversations. So thank you for that. this is probably a conversation for Ms. Grafstrom and providers that I to have separately, but I'm wondering how IHST without training exceptions is factoring into this conversation, and I'd like to understand sort of what is the barrier about IHST without training exceptions when we're talking about folks who, for a variety of reasons, stamina, day programs, you know, other commitments, might not be able to actually engage in the training component at the same level. You know, I really feel like that IHST without training exception piece is pertinent to this conversation, and I haven't really heard us talk about that. I know this is being laid over. I know the department is going to be part of this conversation, and I'd really like to have a broader discussion about that blending and braiding of those services, because I think it's really, really important, especially as we look at program integrity, to make sure that we aren't using IHST with the T just because it pays more. So I'd like to have that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Any further discussion? Seeing none, final word, Representative Curran.
Thank you again, Chair, and thank you so much to our testifiers today. And looking forward to continued work to make sure that we get folks the most flexibility that they can in their day. Thank you.
With that, Representative Kern renews their motion that House File 3375, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. Finally today, we have Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director John Connolly here to discuss some changes that have been in the news over the last week. We were originally hoping to get a budget forecast update this morning. Deputy Commissioner, you are not our second choice, however. We'd much prefer to have this conversation this morning, too. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your update.
Chair Schumacher, John Connolly, Deputy Commissioner and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I appreciate the privilege of being with you all again today. So the reason for my visit here a second time in 2 weeks is to provide an update with respect to the department's ongoing process with respect to program integrity and the focus review specifically with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I'll just review, try to, you know, do this efficiently, what's brought us to this point, and then the recent actions in the last week and, of course, in the last day. There's fresh development in the last 24 hours. So after a year and a half of very focused, intense work to respond to the program integrity gaps that we've all been processing together, and, of course, the legislature passed a number of different program integrity measures last session to work, again, with the administration on these challenges. We received, after, again, an array of different actions, whether it be, you know, changes to programs and policies and provider credentialing and requirements, et cetera, we received a letter on December 5th, both the governor and I did, from different officials within the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the administrator directly to the governor, two deputy administrators addressing a letter to me, asking for urgent action to address program integrity gaps. Of course, with a companion X video outlining the reasoning for that. The four things that were asked for in the December 5th letter were weekly meetings, which we have done. We've agreed to and initiated with CMS, which have processed different things at different times, and I can give you some detail about how that's evolved in the last 2 months. We also were requested to submit a corrective action plan by the end of calendar year 2025, which we did on New Year's Eve. Two things were requested or directed to be a part of that corrective action plan. One of those was a provider enrollment moratorium for the 13 high-risk services that we had identified, in addition to an off-cycle revalidation of all providers in those 13 services. We immediately agreed to both of those things verbally in conversation with CMS and the meetings we had with them in the month of December. We included both of those items in a six-page corrective action plan with other items that we had been working on or aspired to complete as a part of our program integrity work. There were a range of other activities, of course, the department's been engaged in partnership with the legislature, of course, and at the direction of the legislature on these issues, but followed the guidance that CMS gave us with respect to the corrective action plan and the items they wanted to see. A week later, after we submitted the corrective action plan on New Year's Eve, December 31st, we received a letter on January 6th, again from Administrator Oz, indicating that our corrective action plan was deficient. In a letter, there were a number of additional items that they requested in a revised corrective action plan that was to be due on January 30th. We included, and of course, had an on-site visit from CMS in mid-January, a two-day on-site, for a couple of reasons. First was to walk through the items that we were proposing to include in that corrective action plan, and again, speaking to all of the different items that Administrator Oz outlined in his letter. Just seeking, of course, feedback and confirmation that we were on the right path, given that it was 2 weeks after, roughly, we had received the letter. In addition to the initiation of a second piece of what was communicated in that January 6th letter, which was the beginning of a focused review of the 14 services. And that's essentially an audit, a very wide-scoping, wide-ranging audit of the 14 services with a proposed, well, with a $2 billion roughly annualized withholding as a result of the corrective action plan. And the communication was there, of course, until we implement these different items, there would be this withholding. Within several days, we then appealed that withholding amount and the finding of noncompliance, which was the rationale for that with respect to program integrity, and that process is still afoot, so to speak. So we have not had the $2 billion withholding applied yet. That is, again, under appeal within the administrative process within CMS, and CMS is now building their case or argument for the withholding, and that's due sometime midway through this month. So that should be coming within days here. We'll have a chance to respond, and then, of course, there'll be a hearing about that. The second piece now that we are digesting and responding to is the $260 million deferral. These are different processes with respect to CMS and how they do oversight. So the deferral is connected to the focused review of the 14 services, that separate audit apart from the finding of noncompliance and the withholding. That's $260 million that basically they have said they will with a defer, rather, while they begin this focused review of the 14 services. And this is something that we've been through on and off over the years on discrete items, most recently with the emergency Medicaid program here in Minnesota and a review of our operations and cost allocation, eligibility processes, et cetera, for that program. Much more modest deferrals associated with that program. I think $16.5 million in one quarter, $11 million in another. Can get you more detail about how that process has evolved, but much more modest sums. And the reason I give this background is that this will likely continue over several quarters. So that is a much more contained, focused review in which we're providing much more, less expansive, I should say, narrative, qualitative information, data sets to CMS to verify that the claiming for that program was accurate in the time that they're looking at. But that will continue over several quarters just based on the scope of their inquiry. This is much, much, much more expansive. So our concern at this point, of course, is that we received this withholding within 3 weeks of receiving or CMS receiving the information that we initially provided to them that they requested. So a fairly speedy process with respect to determining an amount associated with the withholding. And the deep concern here is that this could go on over several quarters, which could result in $500 million, $1 billion in deferred funding for the state, essentially, the state budget. This is a cash flow issue that could, of course, put the Medicaid program in a very difficult position in addition to the broader state budget, depending on how long this goes on. And we do expect, given prior experience, this could go on for over a year. So that's the deep concern here. And, of course, with the parallel withholding and noncompliance finding and the deferral associated with the focused review that resulted in the different circumstances around those things resulted in the legal action from the Attorney General last evening, both the complaint and the temporary restraining order filed in federal court to basically prevent that from happening. And I'll acknowledge we're still waiting on news about the mechanics of what may happen in terms of how the deferral will be executed. So the timing, whether or not it will be taken off future draws, which are typically biweekly, and that's at state discretion. That's just how we've done it in Minnesota, drawing down federal funding through the federal portal. They have acknowledged last week that this would be applied initially to the last quarter of federal fiscal year 2025. So just to clarify, I think prior statements I made in acknowledging they were a bit confusing, I said Q4 2025, but that's actually the federal fiscal year. So July through September of 2025 is the initial deferral. And again, I think the rationale for this, which was a bit confusing for us, was, again, to, quote, put the screws to Minnesota to make sure that we are serious about program integrity, was really the rationale for this, and to make sure that we had a comprehensive corrective action plan. I'll finish with this. We submitted, of course, the corrective action plan that was over 20 pages on January 30th, so we have not received any feedback yet, asking in our weekly meetings for that feedback or a timeline for it. So it was surprising, to say the least, to receive this and to hear the reasoning for it when we provided a much longer, more extensive corrective action plan to the administration, the federal administration, and hadn't yet received feedback and then received this deferral. So I think I'll pause there. That's a lot of information. Happy to stand for questions about what's happened so far and next steps.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Connolly, for that update for us. First on the list is Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chief. Thank you, Director. A couple questions here. You know, because this is very fluid and so forth, what benchmarks must DHS meet?
Oh, let's turn me on. Okay, there you go. I'm on. Thank you, Representative Knutson. What benchmarks must DHS meet for CMS to fully restore confidence in funding?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, that's a really good question. I think the straightforward answer, and I'll give you some detail for why, is we're not sure yet, but there are a variety of things that CMS is looking at. And again, we're unsure because there was the reference in the press conference with the Vice President and Administrator Oz last week referring to the corrective action plan. So there are a variety of elements in there that we have spoken to and continue to provide information about. So there were milestones due to CMS at the end of February, milestones due at the end of January. So we continue to respond on timelines, time-bound milestones to indicate progress. We're providing data weekly about all of our new processes, whether it's enhanced prepayment review, the revalidation, the off-cycle revalidation of all providers, the providers we've disenrolled. So we're providing extensive data to CMS every single week right now, in addition to updates on different processes and infrastructure that we're putting in place related to program integrity. So that's all moving apace through at least the end of May. That's the timeline for a lot of the corrective action plan elements. However, then there's the new focused review process, which is separate, and looking at the validity of all the claims in the services. So one is looking at the operations of the department. The other is looking at the validity of services retrospectively. And so we're still in a fluid process with CMS about all of the things that they want to see from us. And that's customary for a focused review. But they could ask for claims data. They've asked for 300 providers, a sampling of providers' documentation to validate the services. They'll probably look at county case waiver management procedures, budget setting, et cetera. So this is going to be long, complex, invasive, broad in scope. So I hope that answers your question comprehensively to a degree. We will go through the corrective action plan, and we're doing that as aggressively as we can, and we agree with all of the items they've requested, and we can provide that information to you if you don't already have it. But with respect to the focused review, that's going to evolve and be very fluid. There are usually lots of iterations of data and information requests from CMS as we go through it.
Representative Backer.
Yes, thank you. And Deputy Commissioner, have you, what deadlines has CMS given to you that you have to meet, especially with this $260 million that's kind of put on the side and so forth? What deadlines that would, I have only two more questions, this one and one more, but what deadlines are you looking, having to meet?
That's a terrific question. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, my apologies. So I think the best thing for us to do is to send you the regulation, because this is a very complicated time-bound process with about five different steps to it. But there's like a 60-day time frame in which they have from the end of the quarter to notify us of the withholding. Then we have a time frame for responding. There could be a 60-day extension to that. Then there's a 90-day period for them to consider the response from the state. And then there's a reconsideration possibility with the time frame. So it can go on for more than 9 months. But there's like a call and response piece to this where they have a time frame to notify, we respond, they respond, we respond. But it will likely take many months.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Yes, next question. And that's a little obviously concerning because what's happening to our providers who are the good actors, they're being penalized. So, of course, whenever money's held, that could happen, could definitely happen. What elements on the Minnesota original plan, because obviously it seems like they didn't like something, that's why we got the freeze. what elements of Minnesota's original plan that was put forward that CMS didn't like?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Backer, Chair Backer. If that's permissible.
You can call me Janitor Backer. I don't care. I'm trying to clean up the fraud here. Okay, there you go.
Very good. So they felt that the plan was not comprehensive enough, and that's a fair point of feedback. They just hadn't said that. We responded to the elements in the letter on December 5th and provided all of the different actions that they requested on the response to the January 6th letter, where they indicated it was deficient. So we went back to our existing. Our staff had already put together a very extensive program integrity playbook and spoke to many of the elements in there that they cited, and which we discussed in a December meeting, on-site meeting with CMS leaders. So that was the first kind of round of feedback, so to speak. We haven't received, as I said, any feedback yet on the January 30th revision of that plan. It's much longer. It's over three times as long, many more elements to it, speaking to things like managed care oversight, staff training, how we recover claims that are disallowed and things of that nature. But it's not clear to us, and this is, again, where we were confused about the statements from the Vice President and Administrator Oz last week, that this is actually in response to the corrective action plan, because that's a separate process, the compliance process. It's with respect to their audit of the services. So basically they're saying, and this, again, this happens, they do this where they say, we're going to withhold money until we get all the things we want from you to demonstrate the validity of the claims. What's so deeply concerning about this is CMS has never done this to this extent and breadth and depth before to a state. This is an unprecedented amount, and usually these things are due to a more comprehensive audit of the claims.
Thank
Representative
you.
Backer.
No, we're good.
Representative Hicks.
Rage. That is the only emotion I have been feeling since that announcement. And here's why. Because at the end of the day, we're going to do whatever this is that's happening is going to happen. And what's going to happen is Minnesota taxpayers are going to have to fill in the gaps while we work out this conflict in court. I don't know. I don't even know what we're doing. I mean, I'm like so angry. Because I don't think anybody around this table is saying, well, the feds are holding back the money, so we shouldn't pay the PCAs. Nope, we're going to have to pay the PCAs. I don't think anybody around this table is like, well, there's some concerns about the paperwork and some of the bad actors, so we should shut down the group homes. Nope, not a consensus we have. Okay, cool. So as long as we're all on board about that, I would like to move to what are we going to do to make sure that while the federal government plays politics with our most vulnerable, no one dies because they lose their services. Because we are responsible for continuing to pay those bills. And I am so angry. Because people need these services to stay on the planet. Meanwhile, we're having discussions about bad actors, good actors. All of that is valid and true. And every dollar that goes out that is to someone who did not provide services is incredibly infuriating and wrong. The answer to people being hurt by fraudsters is not to hurt more people. So this is not for you, Commissioner Connolly. This is for us. We need a plan for what are we going to do while $1 billion of federal match is withheld. Who are we going to not provide services to? And that's not just this committee. That's this entire legislature. And if anybody thinks that that's not what's happening, you have your head in the sand. I will not stay silent while our most vulnerable are hockey pucks in some kind of a political game. I would like to remain consistently communicated with about every dollar that is not coming in and what the department's options are at every stage of this game, because I am so scared. I am scared for children and our elderly. I am terrified. And frankly, I have been giving this analogy since this announcement. I feel like the house is on fire
And other people are like, hey, we'd like some water for the garden. And I'm like, hi, I don't have water for the flowers because I've got a house that is burning down. Rage.
Response, Deputy Commissioner?
Chair Schumacher, Representative Hicks, I appreciate that emotion. And I can say two things. First of all, you're absolutely correct. The legislature will have to act to make adjustments to what's in waiver benefits or the state plan. So we'll continue to, as directed by state law, provide those things and provide payment to providers for those things to support people. So that is absolutely correct. It's a cash flow and budgeting issue at a certain point for the state, should this amount pile up over several quarters. And that's the risk that we're deeply concerned about. With respect to what the department is doing in its administrative capacity, we are, of course, already deeply overextended in some ways because of some of the operational and cultural changes that are underway within the department to respond to some of the problems that we've all been digesting together and responding to, in addition to public data requests, in addition to the corrective action plan development and the response to the different items there, and now the focus review, which is extensive and a lot of data and information. So there's a whole lot of additional burden being put on the department to execute all of this, in addition to things like Minnesota Revalidate, which is a part of the revalidation effort in the corrective action plan. So we'll continue to do, I think, some of the things that we've done elsewhere with some of these newer items and requirements from CMS, which is try to get additional state staff from across the enterprise to help us so that we can produce the information and data as quickly to resolve the concerns and to validate the claims. So that's what we'll try to do, is lean in administratively to get this process executed as quickly as we can and substantiate the claims.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. So let's say $250 million from first quarter, $250 million from second quarter. This might be to Mr. Berg. $250 million, we're going into third quarter, right? So we're at $750 million that we don't have. And let's say the court case doesn't solve anything or doesn't move forward or no stay is given or whatever. So in June of 2026, we are looking at a $250 million deficit from what was projected. Do we have to use the emergency funds? Like, Mr. Berg, what does the state have as an option to fill in that hole, or do we start rationing care at that point? Like, at what point do we have to start rationing care? Can we use these reserves? Like, walk me through the fiscal piece of this.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Berg,
Hicks,
as much as you can answer on that.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that question. As you saw from the revenue forecast earlier this week or last week, there is some balance. The state does have healthy reserves. Generally, the legislature has to appropriate those reserves, so the legislature would need to act in some fashion if there's, in fact, a cash flow problem that we need to cover. I believe the department and MMB are currently examining the state's position on that, and I don't know that I can say anything more definitive than that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I will stop. I promise. Just one more thing. You heard Mr. Berg talk about how the legislature would have to act. So this is my final plea. There are lots of people in this state who hear words like fraud and program integrity and think that hammers and bulldozers and blunt instruments are the solution. And I agree that we must do something, but I think we should bring a scalpel, because I am very, very concerned that the current blunt instruments being used are going to hurt our state budget, because we are going to have to fill in the holes or we're going to have to decide who dies. And that is like a real conversation that we have got to have. And I would encourage anyone, particularly my colleagues on the other side who might have the ears of some of our Republican congressional folks, to have real conversations about hammers and scalpels and who they think should die.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Somewhere between Representative Backer's first and 14th question, some of mine were answered. However, I do still have at least one remaining. So we had categories of non-compliance and focused review, and some deficiencies were found. Of course, some of them are quite systematic in how we do things. Our processes, our systems need to be upgraded. Vulnerabilities were located and identified. So my first question for you, I have less than 14, Representative Backer. As these vulnerabilities are being pointed out, are you in agreement with the findings that these are in fact deficiencies, or are they not deficiencies in your view?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair, Representative, is the question with respect to CMS's findings or the things they're pointing out in their letter?
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So all of it coming from the federal government, pointing out deficiencies in our various programs, the totality of it, or any individual one, is there any part of that that you would say, this is not a deficiency, I don't even know what you're talking about?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gander. So I think largely the things that CMS cited in the letters of December 5th and January 6th were things that we had aspired to do, had begun to do. CMS may have asked us, or rather directed us, to do them more expansively or faster than operationally we could without help or assistance. But all of the things that they have asked us to do are things that, again, we had been working on, were included in our program integrity playbook. I will credit CMS with one suggestion, which we've noted, which is disenrolling providers who haven't billed in a year. So that's something we did add to the list of things that we executed, and did that actually before the December 5th letter. So we took that suggestion from them, I think in Q3 of last year, and implemented that. So no, we don't have objection, I think, to the various things that they're asking for. It's more a concern about them saying that we're not serious about this, or they need to put the screws to us for us to act aggressively, when we have done everything they've asked us to do and are on track with all of the timelines and the milestones they've laid out.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I said this to a testifier before, and I'll say it to you also. I appreciate the methodical, objective, tangible steps that you are taking. You're taking them very intentionally. You're taking them in a politically charged environment where it might be difficult to maintain that objectivity, but you're doing it, and my hat's off to you for doing that. So again, in this context of changes and timelines, as we want to have the funding restored, have they given you, say, a benchmark or a standard of completion that if you cross that line, funding will be reopened? Have they kind of told you where that first finish line is that would reopen the funding stream that we need?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gander. So my understanding with respect to, again, I hate to get back into the technicals here, but with respect to the compliance process, the execution, and this is my understanding of conversations with CMS, of the corrective action plan is the major thing in focus for the $2 billion withholding. So that's my understanding of how we resolve that issue. With respect to the quarterly deferral, it's not yet clear to us what will resolve their concerns. So there may be iterations of requests with respect to, again, provider documentation, waiver case manager procedure, claims quality, provider documentation that we'll have to collect from at least 300 providers. So there are a number of things they may ask for as we go through this process, and so we're just not sure what the end of the path looks like, and that's why we're so concerned about the deferral part of this.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I fully agree that the approach needs to be surgical and intentional and mindful and thoughtful and caring for those who need the care the most. But I would also say that desperate times call for desperate measures, and that's exactly the times that we're in here as a state. I think we've seen fraud on the scale that none of us, any of us, care for or approve of. I mean, the people that we represent, they're talking to us every day. You got to stop the fraud. You got to put an end to this. This is horrific. These people have to be held accountable. They have to pay the money back if we can claw that back. and then get ahead of it and identify these fraudsters even before the fraud would happen. So we are in desperate times, and we will be involving desperate measures, and those measures are coming from the Fed, and they're going to be desperate measures that we do inside of here, even to backfill some of these programs in the short term, so those folks who need it the most will get the help they need. Nobody's going to want to see folks suffer. Nobody's going to see folks leave this earth prematurely for lack of care. So that's my final comment. These desperate times, desperate measures, we better all be ready to just step up and get this thing done. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Members, we have about 30 minutes left here, and somehow you all requested in alphabetical order. So we have Fisher, Franzen, Frederick, Gilman, and Knorr.
Love that. Wow.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't realize it was we were so organized around here. We just like working together, I guess. First question I have is for Director Connolly. Is I heard you mention something. I just want to make sure I'm understanding. You say that the $260 million deferral that is occurring is unprecedented. So that has not been done to any other state that you're aware of?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Fisher, no, we're not aware of any other state that's experienced this. And we've tried to do, again, our homework on this one, talk to national experts, people within the networks, other states about their experiences, and are not aware of anything like this happening before.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Director Connolly. Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And the reason I struggle with this a little bit is I'm taking a look at the Department of Justice report on fraud in Medicaid from 2025, and I see in here that Arizona had $650 million that was perpetrated in a fraud scheme. Very significant, but why were they not involved with it? I'm seeing other significant areas out here. I see a $703 million fraud scheme that was perpetrated by Pakistani people. I see a $1.1 billion fraud scheme out there that was for fraudulent claims around wound care. I'm seeing another state that had a $10 billion scheme orchestrated people from Estonia that were on there. And the reason I'm calling these out here is we've seen our president call out a community and targeting a community in our state, I feel very unfairly. And at the same time, we're seeing much larger fraud happening elsewhere in our country. And I'm not seeing the same actions being held against those states. This is from the Department of Justice site. When I go to the United States sentencing site, their top districts for government fraud was Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Texas. I just struggle when I take a look as I'm not seeing penalties. These are the top states. We're not the top states here. I'm seeing the fact that these are red states. These are states that supposedly, and I'm just calling out what I'm seeing here, is that it appears that our government, our president seems to be more on retribution. We've heard from Director Connolly that we have responded to the federal government and they keep on changing goalposts or not getting back to us. What else is going on? When we see levels of fraud that are actually substantially larger and other states with bigger problems than us not experience this type of action, what is really going on in this situation? It is important that we deal with fraud, no doubt about it. I want it rooted out, and I want to make sure that we're taking care of the people who need the services and get them. That is number one. But number two, when we're trying to do that, it feels like we're being signaled out and retribution coming on because we, in my opinion, because we are a blue state. How do you explain the fact that the same thing's not being done to red states, the same treatment's not being held to other areas where there are $10 billion of fraud, my gosh, done by other people of other nationalities, the president never called them out. So why is he being so harsh and unfair to people in our state who are hardworking people and blatantly demonizing a whole category of people?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Fisher, I think we have similar concerns in that we were aware of recent examples, examples further back in history of states, state Medicaid programs specifically with program integrity concerns, problems, and no action like this, at least not on this scale, was taken. And again, I think we as a department have worked with many different external partners, whether it be CMS, whether it be the legislature, whether it be Director O'Malley, taking feedback about how we can change our approach. And so we're here to have that conversation. We want to strengthen what we do and engage with partners to do that. But this feels as though we've crossed a line from engaging with CMS in terms of support and assistance and jointly addressing the problem to a more punitive place, given that we have responded with everything they have requested of us. And so we've moved into a place of penalty that impacts people very very directly rather than helping us solve the problems.
Follow-up, Representative Fisher. Representative Franzen.
Well, good morning, everybody. What a great day to be here, right? Day three of March. So with all due respect to what Representative Hicks had to say, you know, Minnesota taxpayers are already filling the holes, and it's holes in the fraud, right? So the more fraud that we have, more money going out of the system to bad people doing bad things, fraud, waste, and abuse, is more money that taxpayers have to fill in those voids, those holes that have been siphoned out to bad people for our vulnerable people. And I would say that playing politics with our most vulnerable, I would say the fraudsters are paying politics with our most vulnerable people. This committee is very hard, and it takes special people to sit on this committee, each and every one of us, because it is hard work. And I share your concerns, Representative Hicks, and being upset and worried for our vulnerable. I share the frustrations that Representative Fisher has with the heavy-handed approach that the federal government seems to be having with us. But for crying freaking out loud, how many years have we sat on this freaking committee and talked about the waste, fraud, and abuse going in and out the doors? And what has the administration done? Not much. Poo-poo us with poster boards that say this is how we will stop fraud if we start to see things. And here we are now at the climax of it. And more fraud stories, Commissioner, are coming out each and every day. And I don't see it stopping. I don't see it stopping. And who's paying the price? It is our vulnerable people because of the horrible actions that some people have done in this state. And it really irritates me that when we have a target budget to reach, what committee gets cut? It's our committee. Tomorrow, maybe Representative Hicks, you want to join me? I think either today or tomorrow, I have a Zoom call with the FRS providers in my district. That's another tough one, right? Because we changed their whole billing system. And now they're like, how are we supposed to provide for our residents? Also, I have a real hard time listening to Commissioner Connolly and actually believing a word, no offense, but DHS has lied to us many times. Many, many times. So the words that you're telling us, I don't know if I believe them. If you guys are really doing the work and really giving the federal government what you want to do, or if it's just a power play between the Trump administration and the Walz administration, because there's no love lost there, right? And last year when we had to come into this committee and do some cutting because of the rate of growth in Medicaid, how much rate of growth in that Medicaid has related to the fraud, to the waste, to the abuse? And I want to know more about these cultural changes in DHS. What is the cultural change? Is it to tell the truth? To stop the fraud? Is that the cultural change that we're talking about? Because I would welcome that. But this house has been on fire for a very long time. It has been. And now we're dealing with it. At what cost? Because there is a human cost. And the good people are the ones that are suffering, while the bad actors, the fraudsters, are living high on the life of our tax dollars. So I don't know where we go from here. but I know that this all could have been prevented had the fraud not happened. And I don't want to hear anymore, there will always be fraud because we are humans. There will always be fraud. These are tax dollars that are meant to go to our most vulnerable people. And every year I am tired of coming into this freaking committee and cutting our vulnerable people. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen, a lot of comments there. I'll start with the history here. And again, I've been here two years and 5 months with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. About half of my time with the department so far has been dedicated almost entirely to this issue. So I can speak to where I am and where the commissioners and where the leaders and the staff, the hardworking staff, are every single day on this issue and these problems, whether it's nights, weekends, holidays, they are leaning in with every ounce of energy they can right now on this. And you may not believe that, but I see it every single day. And with respect to believing me or trusting the department, what I'd offer is, you know, we're here to provide you whatever evidence we can share that's shareable, that isn't protected or security data with respect to giving a roadmap to fraudsters to commit fraud. We're here to provide the receipts, so to speak. So if there's information that we can help you with to demonstrate that we are executing the corrective action plan, providing the information that CMS is requesting, we will do that. And then the last thing with respect to cultural changes at DHS, just a few examples. I think on the whole, we have started with staff training. That was something that CMS and the department discussed as something we need to enhance. And we have a lengthy program integrity playbook, a video training, and other things that we have created to help staff really understand the different elements of program integrity and the expectations of them, and how, yes, part of their job is every day making sure that people get the services they need, but also making sure the taxpayer is assured that their tax dollars are supporting people in need, as you say. I think the second thing is making sure that everybody sees that program integrity is a part of their job. It's not just for the Inspector General and his team or discrete parts of the department. Everybody has a role to play to make sure that we have appropriate program controls and processes in place to, again, protect the financing, the dollars that are supposed to go to people who need them, people that we discussed and heard about earlier today in the hearing. The last thing I'll say is we've pivoted how we've done the work, and we've acknowledged, I think, Representative Franzen, your points about prior processes, prior practices, just not being up to the task. They were not. We would say that very transparently. Having a reactive tip-based process to deal with program integrity issues and fraud was not adequate. And so we're doing an array of things right now to respond to that, to be more proactive and using analytics and data to be ahead of the fraudsters and the bad actors now and in the future.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you for that, Commissioner Connolly, and for the information that you're willing to give us. The taxpayers paid for a report from the Optum report, and it was 100% redacted from what it looks like. So we asked for information. We got information that we can't use. So I don't know. We asked for information, but can't see it. Can anybody see through this? I can't. I'm a pretty good reader.
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Franzen. So with respect to the report, again, I think the concern is about security data under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. We'll provide whatever data we can under the law to share with you and to demonstrate the actions that we're taking and the different data that we're using. And I think we are searching for ways to provide more information from the report in ways that are permissible, whether it's verbal kind of secure meetings. So we're exploring those options.
Okay. I'll rest my case for now. I'm supposed to keep my heart rate a little low. It's a little high right now.
All right, members, 15 minutes. Representatives Frederick, Gilman, and Knorr. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to address something real quick that when we talk about the budget, we talk about the budget reserves. Nobody wants to give any state dollars to any fraudsters. We don't. But what we're seeing happen is, let's say there's a Medicaid program where 5% of that is going to fraudsters. We want to address that. But what we're seeing the federal government do is cut off 100% of that funding, and so then we have to come as a state to say that other 95% of Minnesotans who deserve these services that are not fraud, we want to make sure that they, I think as Representative Hicks said, stay on this planet, aka stay alive. And so we have to be willing to talk about how can we support them, and that might that means using some of those dollars. That is not about, as I think was stated, giving money to fraudsters. We are looking at the whole picture, and we want to make sure that we protect Minnesotans. And I just want to make that very, very clear, that it is the hammer approach of cutting all of the funding that is causing harm, and we want to be able to keep those safety nets in place. I'm going to pivot to my question. And this is a little bit different from the rest of the conversation that we've been having so far. Over the weekend, I had a conversation with my school district, and they said that there have been some issues with the CPT codes not paying for our health-related services, PCA, special transportation. We've had about 5,000 claims denied. DHS is aware of the issue and is in process of fixing these claims. This has to do with the new CPT code requirements for schools, and what is payable for school-based services. I'm trying to have a better understanding of what's going on, and I'm hoping that you have an answer.
Quite a pivot there, Representative Fredericks. Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Frederick, I'm at a high level aware of that issue and a variety of different efforts with respect to schools' ability to bill and required CPT codes and different claiming requirements. I don't have the texture to satisfactorily answer your question today, but I'm happy to follow up and provide that information. I know multiple policy teams within our department are working on that, and of course regret any disruption or abrasion to school-based services or to the schools themselves.
Representative Frederick.
Final question then. When there is a new code that is needed for a school in this case, how is it determined what code is used? Like, what's that process look like?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Frederick. So typically within the CPT code catalog, there are associations of codes with different services. And again, without particular understanding of the issues or the services that you mentioned some, but I'm most familiar with behavioral health services and the new services that we funded for children with an IEP. And in that case, it's asking for more granular information or more CPT codes to understand specific services that were provided, again, as a part of program integrity, and also just ensuring that we don't have a disallowance risk for the schools and for the state should we have an audit. So that's really my understanding of the request for additional CPT codes around the services, such that we're not using kind of a bundled approach, so we understand what specific services were provided and more specific types of CPT codes with the the texture that helps us demonstrate the permissibility of the service and the appropriateness.
Representative Frederick. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So my question for you, Director Connolly, is why do we need the federal government to hold the purse to find solutions for a broken system? Like, that's what I've been thinking about this weekend. Why has it taken these things happening in order for us to have a very big sense of urgency?
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, that's an appropriate question. And in our view, again, as I aim to convey in my comments earlier, we have been working on this with all seriousness for over a year and a half roughly, and taken action at the initiative of the department, but also at the legislature, that there's been direction and action legislatively to enhance program integrity in a variety of areas in the program. So this is something that we have taken very seriously for a long time. And so in some ways, we engaged CMS proactively during the calendar year of 2025 up until we received the letter on December 5th. And that's why that letter and these recent actions in the last 2 to 3 months are so surprising. We we had to proactively, in many cases, engage them to take steps, and then were again stunned by some of the recent actions as after all of that took place.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And just to follow up about communication, we have been asking and wanted to even meet in the interim as a group here and work even along with our senators to find solutions. When I go home on the weekend, this committee and these problems are on my mind. And you've said that DHS works holidays, nights, weekends. They are working round the clock. We still have not seen like one solution come forward to our body to go, here's what we need to do. I know policy things are coming. We want to see them now so we can meet and talk about this as lawmakers so we can figure out, does this align with truth? And again, program integrity is on the hearts and minds not only of our committee, but everybody around Minnesota and now impacting us nationally. I love that there is highlights on the waste, fraud, and abuse because we can have things more streamlined to take care of those most vulnerable. What I'm disappointed in is our administration still has not come to meet with us. He has literally taken his administration, and DHS has been a part of it, the most vulnerable and said, I am going to just keep kicking this can down the road. And we have a very short window of time. So my question to you is, what is the communication coming forward? The redacted, you know, we talked about that, but is that in your corrective action plan? The information that you got from that report, is that in your corrective action plan? We can't see it. Do we need to bring an amendment? We could do a sense of, like, do we need to bring an amendment to say that legislators get to see what's in that report so we can get to work? Because it seems like every week that goes on is less of a chance for us to get anything done. And it's nauseating to me because it feels like this is a waste of our time. And there are vulnerable people, and there are people that are caring for people. There's providers that are trying to figure out how they are going to keep going. Yet we have people who now are negating the system that are not able to get a license here, a provisional license here. So they're finding other avenues. I just talked with a vendor this weekend, and he said they have literally moved from this address here, and now they're kind of coming over here on the side. Hearing those things nauseates me. So we need information, and I want a date. When are you going to let us know the information so we can get rolling on it? That's where I'm at.
Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, the first thing I'd say in response is we're happy to meet with you anytime to talk about your ideas. So, and I mean that. Let's talk. Let's meet. With respect to ideas and steps, we're happy to document what's been done in the last year and a half to kind of provide that evidence to you in terms of what we can share. Glad to provide you that list and any results or data pursuant to kind of the actions we took. And then with respect to forthcoming actions, so the governor's anti-fraud package was released. There are an array of actions included in that. We're happy to talk through them with you. And I think I'll say to you what I said to Chair Robbins yesterday. We are glad to have conversations with anybody who's got good ideas. We think there are a lot of really strong, robust steps in the governor's package, but happy to have conversation about what else we can do. We'll take good ideas from anybody. So if you want to have that meeting, we're here to have it.
Representative Gilman.
And then, again, did you answer my question? Is your findings in the Optum report in the your compliance action plan?
Deputy Commissioner Connell.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, the straightforward answer is yes. So what we did is we looked at the different elements of the corrective action plan, and I will acknowledge there are pieces of this, of course, that can't be public. That's speaking to Representative Franson's concerns about the redactions. But we have crosswalked the different pieces of the Optum report in terms of the recommendations to the corrective action plan, and there is a lot of association between the two in terms of things that speak to different parts of the corrective action plan. A lot of the different recommendations in the report, though, really speak to billing policy in particular, and so there's a lot of a high volume of items related to that and how they correspond to the corrective action plan. So you might see less in other parts like staff training that aren't as spoken to in the report, but certainly there is a crosswalk happening, and different policy teams are doing that work right now to dig in.
Representative Gilman. All right. Finally, today we'll have Chair Knorr, and then Deputy Commissioner, if you want a final word after that, you're welcome to it. Chair Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First of all, I just wanted to say thank you for the work that the agency is doing. And in order for us to show you the respect, I know you've been going through hard time trying to make sure that you meet all these deadlines that I keep, things that are changing frequently. And you've already noted this is unprecedented. This is not something that we've ever seen. This is going to disseminate, it's going to end Medicaid services for the state of Minnesota. We haven't quantified what is coming to us. And I know you noted from the beginning, there's that $515 million quarterly withholding. Annually, it's $2 billion. Let's pause for a minute. $515, $2 billion with the threat from the federal government to do withholding, which we are waiting for the final results for the hearing request by next week so that we know what's happening with that 515 withholding. On top of that, there's a quarterly deferral, meaning that the federal government is starting to defer $259 million, starting with the quarter ending in September. Now we have got another quarter coming in December, the end of March, so technically we've got 60 days to reach the annual quarterly process. So that is going to be another $1 billion. In total, that is $3 billion. Nothing in our budget will be able to pay for that. Nothing, not even our reserves, because we cannot continue on that trajectory. That means anyone who is dependent on medical assistance or any other program that is funded through the state is going to pay the price. And there's no timeline. And I'll put it this way. If we don't hear from the federal government what we need to do as part of the corrective action plan that you've submitted for the $515 million withholding, that means operational system for DHS, operational system for the providers, for MCOs, the education, everything that was included in there. If we don't have a plan, the session will come to an end and we will be back here. I don't want to come back for a special session. I want to deal with this issue now and solve it before we leave this place. Sometimes we may be hearing things, but we need to quantify what will happen, because by the end of this process, that deferral went back instead of starting where we are right now. And that means if there's a disallowance from that amount of $259 per quarter, it is a loss to the state of Minnesota. And that will happen, I can guarantee you. Disallowance is going to happen. The budget for the state of Minnesota will have to pick up and pay that to the federal government. And so we should not be waiting for the agency to come to us. We've done some amazing work last session to get started with, collectively, we passed some strong legislation on program integrity. And yes, we had some hearings last week to start that process. We need to build on what we started. We need to come with a plan ready to move forward to ensure that by the time somebody is approved through eligibility process in how our systems, because technology is another major issue that we'll have to address, to the recipients, to the providers, to the MCOs, this is upon all of us to have a roadmap of reaching a consensus and agreeing to things with the federal government and having legislation to address all those issues. Mr. Chair, we've got work to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Knorr. And if you think you don't want to come back for special session, final word, Deputy Commissioner Connolly.
Chair Schumacher, Chair Knorr, thank you for those comments. I'll just say again, we are working every day very earnestly to achieve two key imperatives, among other things, but the two key imperatives of making sure that people get the services that they need and are entitled to, including some we heard from today earlier in the hearing, and making sure that program integrity is as strong as it possibly can be. We want to be a pace car for Medicaid program integrity in Minnesota, and that's the outcome of this process. That is our goal, that is our aim. And what I'll say is, again, just really appreciative of the conversation, the time today, the feedback, and we're here to, again, work with all of you on the solutions that will help us get to that goal of being the strongest state in the nation for Medicaid program integrity. And again, we're open for ideas and look forward to working with you all.
Deputy Commissioner Connolly, the committee thanks you for your time. With that, we get to be back here tomorrow morning, 8:15. Until then, we are adjourned.